The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. Welcome to today's training, Connecting the Science to Managing LNAPL Sites, Part 3, Using LNAPL Science, the LCSM and LNAPL Goals to Select an LNAPL Remedial Technology. My name is Devin Setchkar. I am your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. I will cover just a few points before we start so that you know how you can actively participate today. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2018, and although we will be able to share a lot of information with you today, we will not be able to share all the tools and resources available in this guidance document. So we strongly encourage you to take a look at it if you have not already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you're working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. So today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. As I mentioned before, we are recording this event to make it available for on demand for those who are not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of their slides as we move through today's session. If you would like to have your own slides to control, you are able to download slides from the initial training page that you were directed to today. You can also access you can access them on the CLUIN training page that brought you to the training today. In Zoom, we do have access to the Q&A window where you can ask questions or report any technical issues that you have during this training. We will have 2 Q&A breaks during the training, and we'll get to as many questions as we can verbally. If we have too many questions to answer verbally, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person in writing through the Zoom Q&A window. There is an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you will be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will be able to certify that you participated, and once you do so, a certificate will be issued to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you are participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's LNAPL team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document and participate in this training course. A special thank you to them all for participating today. If you would like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios on the CLUIN training page that directed you here today. With that, we will move to the next slide, and I am going to pass it off to our first presenter, Tom Fox.
Thank you, Devin. Okay, so here's hoping I have control. All right, so welcome everybody. This is part 3 of the LNAPL training series that ITRC sponsors. We're going to assume that everybody attended part 1 and part 2. Part 2 was 2 weeks ago. And we'll be quickly moving into our part 3 content. As a reminder, the ITRC document is available at the website link at the top of this slide. The updated document includes an expansion of a lot of key concepts about LNAPL, a completely new LCSM section, a focus on SMART goals, and it also has expanded appendices which talk about LNAPL transmissivity and natural source zone depletion. There are also appendices in there that deal with LNAPL sheens and even fractured rock situations. Devin, did the slide advance?
It did not. It says it's still waiting for you to take control. Can you click? There you go.
Aha, sorry.
Perfect.
There we go. Okay, we're off. So our three-part training series involves these sections that are shown here. And part one was basically to introduce you to a lot of the new science and understanding about LNAPL in and of itself. Part two was working on your LNAPL conceptual site model. You can't solve a problem until you understand it. And part three, which we'll be talking about today, is going to cover selecting and implementing LNAPL remedial strategies. And after this training, we expect that you are then going to apply the knowledge you've gathered from this IBT seminar and use it in your day-to-day work. So our learning objective today is to understand what the LNAPL remediation technology groups are. And we're going to be talking about those at length today, especially Lloyd. We're also going to talk about why they've been grouped and also how site goals and objectives can influence your selection of a technology group from which you can choose a specific technology. There is a linkage between the remedial goals and remedial objectives, and people often get these terms confused. So let's go over these a little bit. So basically, a saturation goal means that you have LNAPL mass in the ground that you can, you know, remove from a well or with a system if necessary, and that the recovery or control of that LNAPL is your objective. So by doing that, you would either reduce the LNAPL saturation or the LNAPL mass by removing the LNAPL, or you would stop the migration by containing or creating a barrier around the LNAPL to stop the migration. A compositional goal means that you need to invoke a phase change. You need to change the composition or the chemistry of the LNAPL. And in this case, we're going to be looking at some of the LNAPL characteristics from our very first seminar, the chemistry of petroleum, to see how we can alter the composition of the LNAPL and reduce its risk. And finally, we can have an aesthetic goal, which could be either a saturation or a compositional goal in a sense, but really it deals more with an appearance or a nuisance type situation. But in some cases may even get to the point where it's a geotechnical type of issue where the soil itself needs to be removed. So let's talk a little bit about technology groups. We have broken the technologies into three different groups, as I've kind of alluded to already. We're going to talk about mass control. And when we do talk about mass control technologies, you'll note as part of each technology, there's a little triangle. And a small dot will be shown in the corner of the triangle to indicate really what kind of a technology group we're talking about. And the same you'll see is under mass recovery. We will then see a dot. I hope we will. Aha, a little bit of an internet delay. A mass recovery will have a dot in its corner and the same situation for phase change. So now you also note later on in some of the slides where there's a blur between two or even three different technology groups. And that's because the technology may actually act in more than one fashion. So the key point here to breaking technologies into groups is to simplify the selection of the technology and make it a little bit easier for anybody to find what they think they need to use. This is a diagram, a figure 5-3 out of the document that kind of summarizes a lot of the linkages that we are going to talk about today. This diagram shows the LNAPL state, which we've talked about, and the LNAPL concern, which we've also talked about. It then links it to the technology groups and the recoverability of the LNAPL in question. So mass control and mass recovery is only used when LNAPL saturation is greater than residual. Mass control is used where there's an LNAPL migration risk. So only under very high saturation conditions are you concerned about migration of LNAPL. Mass recovery is used when LNAPL is mobile. In other words, it'll show up in a well and practically recoverable. And I use the word practically in the EPA sense of the term. When LNAPL is less than saturation, only phase change technologies are going to be working. And phase change technologies can also be applied to mobile and even migrating LNAPL. The recoverability is represented here by the transmissivity number, which we show at the bottom. And the LNAPL transmissivity range of 0.1 to 0.8 is the rough lower limit for recovery of LNAPL from a well or some other installation. So basically, we're trying to consolidate our science, our concerns, and our practical solutions all in this one figure. And basically, generally, you're going to be progressing from right to left as we go forward in the next slide. So when we select technologies, we consider multiple treatment technologies, or in fact, we implement them in a treatment train type of mechanism. For example, you may begin with a slurry wall, which is going to be a mass control technology to control migration of LNAPL, and that's generally an immediate and fairly short-term risk at a site. Then you may move on to a mass recovery technology, such as a pump and treat or a dual pump liquid extraction system, whereby you're recovering the mass of the LNAPL, and that in turn will reduce its migration potential. Phase change technologies such as air sparging or soil vapor extraction could then be used to further remove LNAPL mass and potentially address vapor and groundwater risks. Notice we are in the phase change train car now. So the final treatment technology that we'll be talking about at length today is going to be natural source zone depletion. Basically, all hydrocarbons are biodegradable. The rate that they degrade, of course, is debatable and varies from site to site, but it is finally basically the MNA phase for natural source zone depletion. So let's talk a little bit about treatment trains. Treatment trains are good when they're planned and the consultant is using SMART objectives. You're using metrics to judge when is the time to change from one technology to another, or even to stop using a technology, and you select endpoints for the technology. It's a very orderly implementation, well thought out plan of how you're going to address your LNAPL mass using the treatment train that I just showed in the last slide. Now, treatment trains can be implemented very poorly when they're unplanned, they lack specific SMART objectives, they have no metrics, and the endpoints are very vague. And this is typically illustrated when people simply throw the next technology at the problem as they cast about for a solution and really don't put much thought into what they're doing to try to solve the problem. The technology series tables in Appendix A of the document go through a lot of detail for each of the technologies that we'll talk about later. So I just want you to know that these technology tables are there to help you select. And we'll go through some of that a little bit later, as I said. So let's talk about LNAPL mass control, which is the first technology grouping that I've already mentioned. So let's dive a little bit deeper. When you have excess saturation and your remedial goal is to remove that, and you're concerned about migration, then LNAPL mass control is really the technology group you want to be paying attention to. Mass control technologies are basically blocking the effects of the LNAPL from reaching somewhere else, preventing the spread of the problem. So like a dam across a river, as we show in this illustration, it holds back the LNAPL. Note the ternary diagram in the lower right-hand corner shows the dot in the mass control section of the triangle. This slide links the concerns, goals, and objectives. So your concern here is that the LNAPL is going to migrate and spread the risk or the exposure risk that is at your site. And so basically we want to terminate that LNAPL body migration and reduce the risk by stopping the LNAPL migration. In this situation, we've selected a physical barrier of some type, maybe a slurry wall or something like that to cut it off. So this migration concern can be addressed by a mass control technology. So the next category we're going to talk about is mass recovery. And a nice way to think about this is you've got a water leak in your basement from your water heater, you've got some water in the floor, and you want to get the water back up off the floor. So we're removing the LNAPL, or in this case in the image, water, to the maximum extent that we can. We're not going to get the water, the floor totally dry, but we're going to remove any excess mass that we can. So this is a good analogy for mass recovery. The shop vac will not get all the water, but we're going to leave it in a state where we can then deal with it by other means. Recovery will also allow for faster natural drying so that the life cycle of the spill is reduced. This slide links the LNAPL concerns with LNAPL occurrence in wells to a saturation-based goal of reducing LNAPL when LNAPL is above the residual range. Okay, in other words, it will show up in a well, it's mobile. You can achieve this goal by recovering enough LNAPL to reduce the LNAPL saturation, its mobility, and the gradient that it's under. And so this concern, goal, and objective would be addressed through mass recovery technologies. Devin, I'm sorry, for some reason I seem to be, there we go. Our last grouping is phase change, and you'll notice the ternary diagram in the lower right again. We've got our dot in the phase change corner. So it's not time for a coffee break yet, I'm sorry to say, but we are going to be then talking about how do we change the composition of the LNAPL. So our concern, for example, might be that we have a risk from vapor intrusion. Our goal is to reduce the concentrations of those toxic compounds that we're concerned about. And to do that, we're basically going to deplete the volatile or soluble constituent that's in the LNAPL itself or that resides in the media that we're concerned about. So the key point here is we want to reduce the risk by removing the risk-driving constituents in the LNAPL itself. Now, this diagram is really very helpful to illustrate the difference between compositional and saturation goals. So a compositional change is really important because it directly reduces the risk that the LNAPL presents through most risk exposure scenarios. It's a more effective way to target constituents of concern that are actually a very small fraction of the total LNAPL mass. For example, benzene is just one of many hydrocarbons that make up gasoline, but in many cases, it's the only component driving risk. And benzene makes up a very small percentage of even gasoline, for example, somewhere in the range of 2 to 5% typically. So using a phase change technology to reduce the benzene concentration in the gasoline, in other words, moving from point A to point C on this diagram, will drastically reduce the risk and be more effective at recovering some, but not all, of the bulk of the gasoline. Now, the gasoline itself could be removed by moving from point A to B. In other words, we're removing the mass, moving along, but the amount of benzene that's present is still there, even though we've reduced the mass of the gasoline. But by removing the benzene directly, we directly reduce the risk and move the project toward closure that much sooner. So the composition and saturation goals are conceptually compared, and then a reduction in saturation has very little effect on the dissolved concentration unless almost all the LNAPL has been removed. So we have a quick knowledge check here. What are the three technology groups? You have a choice of unconfined, perched, and confined, mass control, mass recovery, and phase change, air sparging, skimming, and excavation, or aesthetics, saturation, and composition. And we'll leave that to a vote for a few minutes. Devin, are you tracking the votes?
Yes, I am. We'll give it just like 10 more seconds, and then sure. I'll show it.
Okay, so we have mass control, mass recovery, and phase change is the overwhelming vote. Thank you for paying attention. And at this point, we'll be moving on to let Tom Palaya talk a little bit about natural source zone depletion.
All right, thanks, Tom, and appreciate the intro. Like Tom mentioned, the natural source zone depletion a topic is relatively new to folks, so I wanted to just do a quick cover on this. There's lots and lots of papers on this subject. So We're going to do what we can in the short amount of time that we have here to cover the important salient parts for your practice. But just know there's lots more detail in the ITRC LNAPL 3 document, specifically Appendix B. So lots of details there. We'll cover some of the key things here. So as Tom mentioned, it's important because, well, it's new. And second of all, it's a key part of our CSMs as well as our remedial technology selections. So just want to kind of hit that highlight. It's not like other techs because it's happening at all of these sites. So as Tom mentioned again, this is a bit of an extension of the monitored natural attenuation technology set, or process set, I should say, where you have biodegradation occurring in LNAPL source zones now. So we'll kind of go through that here. And let's see if I can advance these slides. There we go. It's taken a few seconds. And I thought there was a poll in here, Devin.
There was. I was just going to say we did just, are you ready for it?
Yeah, let's do it. I just wanted to kind of get a feel for folks in the audience. Have you heard of and or used, i.e. measured natural source zone depletion at any of your sites? So just give that a couple of seconds here to just get a sort of a baseline starting place on where we are as a group with understanding of natural source zone depletion. Two thirds say no. Okay, that's pretty common, actually. It's actually a little bit higher in the yes category, so that's actually promising. It's technology that's been around for a while, but you know, sort of new-ish in the ITRC. I mean, started in 2009 as an introduction, but our 2018 document really covers it in detail. So that's good. I'm glad to see a little more than a third of the group has heard of it and maybe even used it. So let's get to it. Some of the learning objectives here. We'll go through a little bit of the science, you know, what it means. What is this natural source zone depletion thing? Where is it happening? And just really stress the part that it's happening at most of, if not all of our sites. And so it's something that you can't really fully develop a CSM until you measure it. We're gonna also encourage pulling that into your CSM. And there's a few different methods you have to choose from. And we'll go through just a quick overview of those so you can pick one that best fits your site. And then finally at the end, kind of go through how NSCD might be used as a remedial alternative. So certainly has its niche at sites with low threat and low risk, sites that are palatable in terms of longer remediation timeframes, for example, and have some institutional controls, things like that in place. So here's the sort of new conceptualization, and let me see if I can get a pointer. Well, maybe you guys can see my pointer on the screen here. Oh, no, here it is. Let's just use the pen. So historically, we've done a really good job of measuring biodegradation processes in the saturated zone. And so what is new here is that we have seen that we missed a large portion of the biodegradation byproducts, and those are the gases. So that's the key takeaway here for natural source zone depletion, and what exactly that means is it's actually biogases that are generated through methanogenesis of the NAPL in the ground. Keep in mind, this can be the light petroleum NAPL type or also the dense petroleum NAPL type. They're all undergoing biodegradation processes, both in the saturated zone and then the capillary and unsaturated zones, generating methane, even some CO2. That migrates then upwards through the vadose zone. And where it clashes or collides with the oxygen coming from atmosphere, you get hydrocarbon oxidation. And so that basically converts your methane and VOCs to CO2. And incidentally, at that interval where that hydrocarbon oxidation occurs, you also get heat generation. So that's kind of this halo here. That's kind of the key aspect of NSCD. We're measuring these gases. You can actually see it at ground surface, but you'll see a little later, there's other methods you can use, the temperature, as well as soil gas profiles to measure those rates. And so you take that byproduct quantity and then use stoichiometry, just like you did for the saturated zone, to estimate your hydrocarbon degradation rates. So that's the big new thing here. It's not so much the process itself has always been going, but it's more the techniques and the focus now on quantifying and better totally quantifying how much bio we have at these sites. So as I mentioned earlier, lots of science behind this, literally thousands of papers, and just a couple of key things to take away. First off, the methods we'll present to you today are a bulk measure. So they're measuring CO2 at ground surface or in the subsurface and or temperatures. Those are as a result of biogases generated from biodegradation of all the biodegradable petroleum hydrocarbon constituents. So that's why we call them a bulk measure. From what we're seeing, they appear to be relatively constant. So there's some good papers out there, and ITRC LNAPL 3 document summarizes those on how this could be zero order. It's a little bit flies in the face of traditional understanding where biodegradation is first order, but there's so many different variables involved that it essentially is a net zero order. So over our period of monitoring over the past, say, 10 plus years now, we've seen constant degradation rates. The other key thing is direct contact oil biodegradation. So this is something that has been in the science for quite a while, but maybe something we sort of didn't focus on as much as we should have. Traditionally, we've thought of biodegradation being a dissolution of the NAPL into the aqueous phase, and that's where biodegradation takes place. So we always kind of had this mass transfer limitation. Well, it turns out, and here's a good electron microscopy photo here in the bottom, that shows that the bugs can actually take the oil into their cell walls in some cases and directly feed off of the oil itself. So that is one of the primary reasons why we can, or how to explain some of these large rates that we're getting. And then there's data out there from, this is from the Bemidji site in Minnesota, lots of papers and study on that site, that kind of show you another interesting phenomenon that back up the direct contact oil biodegradation theory, is that, you know, we're seeing losses of carbon compounds in the C20 plus just as fast as we're seeing losses in the smaller carbon range. So the darker color, the bolder line here, is the starting oil concentration of these various different carbon compounds in the alkyl cyclohexane range. And you can see the delta at these various different sites between the starting and the current levels is relatively large, big drops. And so that's another key point here, is that not only are we, you know, not mass diffusion limited by the dissolution, but we're also getting direct degradation of some of the larger carbon compounds too. So that's how we get these NSCD rates. So that's a little bit of science. Now, how do I use this? So say I go out there and measure it, what am I going to use the data for? And so here's some ideas. First off is to envision your NAPL or your NAPL body as a glacier. And initially you had a release, say, up in the mountain zone, and you had a head that was driving it down gradient, or down the mountainside in this case. Well, analogous to evaporation and melting, the NSCD processes are ramping up and actually get to a point where they exceed the rate of advance of the glacier, certainly after the release has stopped. But that explains how, you know, the terminus area here of the glacier, how you see at a NAPL site, the parallel here, stained soils, but no NAPL in wells. And so over time, NSCD processes, just like evaporation and melting, work on the oil body and actually cause the NAPL body to recede. So that's a really good way, if you can quantify the rate of NSCD and look at rates of advance of your NAPL body and see that your NSCD is greater, it explains the receding NAPL body scenario. Other way you can use it is either basically benchmarking the practicability of recovery or determining an endpoint for your recovery systems. So it's a number. You know, you get a number like gallons per acre per year. It's kind of a new unit, but it's relatively straightforward. And we've created a box plot here to kind of show some example data. We glommed it together from a few different publications that are out there just to kind of compare skimming systems and even aeration systems like AirSparge SCE or multi-phase extraction to rates of natural source oil depletion. So on order of 1,700 gallons per acre per year in the literature is about the average. So that is the dashed line that kind of cuts across the box plots here. And then the plots have these two technology sets broken up in early stage, which is basically the first year of operation, and then post first year. So as you know, when you install these remediation systems, the mass recovery rates are great at the start, but they fizzle out as they deplete the hydrocarbons around them. So really the point of this chart is to show that initially, the rates of mass removal or remediation is greater with these systems. But there comes a time pretty quickly, actually, where the rate of natural processes, depletion of hydrocarbons with biodegradation, exceeds them. And so that's an important sort of benchmark and can be used as an endpoint metric for your systems to determine when to transition. And then similarly, if you're in a scenario where the stakeholders are sort of like, that's great, I'm glad I have natural processes cranking away, but I need something more, you can use your measurements and results from NSCD to figure out how to enhance it. So low temperature thermal systems, for example, enhanced anaerobic with sulfate addition, for example, or even aerating the headspace of your sites. All three of those have been used in the past to enhance rates of NSCD. So great. Here's the science. Here's how I might use it. So, okay, I'm on board. Here's how we measure it. So we've got four different methods in the ITRC LNAPL 3 document. Again, details in Appendix B, so hop to that. One note is that there are more methods out there being developed. So it's definitely an evolving science. One method, the chemical compositional change method, is particularly new. So I just wanted to call that out. You know, we have, these are bulk measure, total hydrocarbon losses. People are working on chemical specific methods. And so keep your eyes and ears open for upcoming publications from other organizations and the ITRC on some of these other methods. So here's the four that we included. First is soil gas gradient method. This involves using traditional vapor monitoring probes, measuring gradients of carbon dioxide, oxygen, and even methane in the ground, and using those via Fick's law, so it's pretty simple math, to estimate the flux of CO2 out of your source zone. Key factor here is you need to measure a soil gas diffusivity value, so you'll see some specifics in there on the importance of it, so pay close attention to that, and then the importance of monitoring a couple times over time, just to understand the stability of those profiles. The second method is your passive flux trap. Really nice ground surface-based method. Has a sorbent material in the top of it. So you basically have two different pucks of sorbent material. The bottom puck here traps CO2 coming up through the 4-inch or however large receiver pipe you have and traps it. And then there are times when you get soil gas gradient reversals where atmospheric oxygen or CO2 might be tempted to go back through the pipe. So there's a top sorbent there to capture that and basically keep that bottom puck protected. So that basically measures over about of a 2-week period of time, total carbon sorbed, and then you can estimate a flux from that. The key thing with the passive flux trap here is that you can also run 14C on the beads or on the material trapped by that lower puck. And so using atomic mass spectrometry, you can basically use it as a way to decipher what CO2 is coming from natural organic matter and what CO2 is coming from petroleum hydrocarbons. So background correction is a key aspect of all of these methods. I'm calling it out for the passive flux traps just because there's a nice way using 14C to measure it, but you've got to address that for all the methods. Again, all the details are in Appendix B of the guidance document. The dynamic closed chamber is method number three, very similar to the trap, but it's a quick measurement. So on the order of 90 seconds, you put your chamber down. This particular unit is a LICOR unit. It's got an infrared gas analyzer in here to measure your CO2 concentration. Circulate gas through the closed chamber on a shallowly embedded, so both the traps and the DCC are very shallow, inch or 2 inch in the ground. The concept is not to disturb the gas flow. So real quick measurement, CO2 accumulation over time, get you your CO2 flux. Background correct, locations outside of your NAPL footprint. That's how you do it for the DCC. And then lastly is the heat I mentioned earlier. There are thermodynamic calculations that you can use. All the details are in Appendix B, to basically take this delta curve. So you'll see if you measure temperature in the soil with depth in that hydrocarbon oxidation zone, you'll see a temperature increase, 1, 2, 3 degrees C type numbers. And then you can use those numbers with the calculations in the guidance document to actually estimate your NSCD rates. Much more mathematically complicated than the others, but nonetheless a good method to take a look at if for some reason these other methods won't work for your sites. So a good example are sites where there's pavement over the top. Obviously your traps and your chambers are not going to work so well. Look at the other two methods. So lots of different logic in the document to help you pick what's the best method for your site. All right, the last part of this is really just kind of demonstrating a scenario that Tom actually called out earlier, how to transition to NSCD from other systems. So as we mentioned, lots of other systems hit that practical recovery limit, still not done yet. And so it's an opportune or ideal scenario to transition to NSCD. So here's a site, jet fuel pipeline release site, had a geology of silt and clay. The interesting thing about this site, so sandy aquifer down here at the bottom. Interesting thing about this site is local groundwater use for drinking and other purposes stopped shortly after the release occurred. So when the release occurred, the El Napo distributed itself at the capillary fringe that had existed at that time during groundwater, local groundwater use. Well, the stop of that actually caused submergence of the NAPL underwater. And so that's where you see this. All of this, 100% pretty much, is submerged. That does not stop the biodegradation from occurring, and it doesn't stop the gases from coming out. So through ebullition and various different ways, the gas migrates up and comes out the ground surface, just like we've shown at the other describing the CSM for NSCD. We measured it. So we did our sort of history here. We did excavation, skimming, very typical site, and removed, 10,000 gallons with skimming, another 10,000 with SVE. And as is typical, the mass removal curves flat lined out. And so we're looking for what's next. We hadn't reached our regulatory drivers yet. So ITRC's got a great, some flow charts in here to kind of help you walk through, identifying the need and then going through a few different steps on, is it time to go through a transition? And then if so, three different sort of lines of evidence sets, you could say, to pull together to help rationalize or justify the transition. So that information, that data is what helps you get the transition through the stakeholder review process. So here's what we did for this site. We had the risk reduction set. We did the technical set as well. And then life cycle costs really were a non-issue. All these other lines of evidence were able to justify moving on. So a couple photos here in the bottom of the slide that show we both use the CO2 passive flux traps and the dynamic closed chamber. So the closed chamber, we surveyed the entire site and did a subset of locations with passive flux traps to basically quantify the NSCD rates. And what we found was it was on the order of 1,000 plus gallons per year coming off with natural source zone depletion versus the systems that were only doing at best 100 gallons per year. So that's a pretty typical scenario. NSCD, just a rough wag at the beginning of your project, is on the order of 10 times better than what your remediation systems, your mechanical systems are doing. So take a look at your own sites and judge for yourselves how much of the improvement you're seeing is actually from NSCD versus your recovery systems. So these are the lines of evidence, the risks. We had to cover off all the risk, make sure it was in a legally enforced use area so nobody could get at the groundwater in this relatively urban commercial industrial area. No threat of migration. We had good documented geostatistics there to show that. We had the land use controls in place, and that along with transmissivity, we had to make sure we had to document the recoverability and the mobility of that was low at 0.5 square feet per day. We're able to use that to put the argument together to the regulators to show that it's time to move on. So that's it. Just to kind of quickly summarize, and there's a poll coming up as well. Hopefully, yeah, that's great. So thanks for putting that up, Devin. Poll question, why is it important to understand NSCD at your sites? So maybe fill that out while I'm going through the summary here. Just to recap, it's happening at our sites. Let's account for it and take credit for it and incorporate it into your CSM. Lots of different methods out there. Take a look at the Appendix B as well as some other documents out there, ASTM coming soon. CRC care is another good one to pick the right method based on your site conditions. And then think about it. How does it fit? Does it fit the risk profile of it at your site, et cetera? So swing back over to the poll results here. See how we did. You guys are on it. This is great. So really good. Hopefully that helped introduce you to the NSCD science and maybe help encourage you to include it on your projects. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Lloyd Dunlop with TriHydro, and he's going to talk a lot more about other technologies. So over to you, Lloyd. I will kick it one more slide, and you're good. Or you can.
Yeah, I actually took control back. Sorry about that, Tom.
Okay, there you go.
Okay. So let me see if I can advance these. Okay, great. That worked. Okay. Again, Lloyd Dunlap here. So as Tom mentioned earlier, the technologies are broadly grouped into a document on how they address our LNAPL concerns. So we use this triangular diagram here in the lower right to identify how a technology can address a concern. So example, if LNAPL migration is your concern, your mass control technologies are probably the first group of technologies you want to look at. Now, your goal could be like contain LNAPL at a defined boundary, such as that. Okay. So now, but if LNAPL saturation is your concern, you want to focus on your mass recovery technologies. Your goal could be like abate LNAPL body migration and mobility by removal of LNAPL mass. And if your LNAPL residuals or compositional effects, you want to focus on your phase change technologies. And your goal could be like abate contaminants from emanating from the LNAPL source, like Tom mentioned before. Okay. Now, like Tom also mentioned, these technology groups can sometimes overlap. You have these here, for example, this can be good if they do overlap because they can address several LNAPL concerns at one time. And the technologies that don't overlap can be used in treatment trains or a combination of other technologies to enhance or accelerate cleanup. Okay, so here's another way to list the technologies within their groups. You have phase change up here on the top. You have mass control over here on the right. On the lower left, you have mass recovery. As we said, some technologies fit within more than one group. Now, for example, you have total liquid extraction down here that is both a mass control technology and a mass recovery technology. Okay, let's first talk about some mass control technologies. Now, mass control technologies typically are physical containment or hydraulic containment, like you see up here in the top. But you can see some other mass control technologies here that you're probably going to recognize. Now, we're going to refer to the ternary diagram down here at the bottom to see that we're talking about now MC or mass control. You just want to make sure and refer to your tables in 6.1, 6.2, 6.3, and Appendix A to find out all you want to know about these kind of technologies. Now, performance metrics are very, very important for anything you're doing out there with your remediation. So you want to make sure and look at tables 5.2 and 5.3 for metrics. Here is a common metric that you can use, like no first LNAP occurrence in a downgradient well. Or another one could be your LNAP body footprint is stabilized based on long-term monitoring. So these are just some examples. So again, you want to make sure and understand and put in some good metrics. And the guidance document has listed some very good ones in tables 5.2 and 6.3. Okay. Okay, good. Now, let's show you an example of how to select a technology. Let's first say you have a site where the LNAP is migrating toward a river. So that would be from the process we learned in session two, your concern would be LNAP migrating to a river. And this is discussed in table 5.1. Now, your goal is LNAP saturation based, and you want to stop the LNAP migration. And you also look at that in table 5.1. Now, what you need to know, your next one is your remedy LCSM. You want to make sure and review or update your LCSM to select a remedy. That's talked about in section 4.4. Now, what are some examples? Well, you may have some results now of testing or modeling or bench scale or pile scale tests or other factors like cost or liability concerns to help you update your LCSM. And that's, again, found in section 4.4. Okay, so now let's continue on with this example. And next you want to select a SMART objective. And this, remember that SMART stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Now more about this can be found in tables 5.1 and also section 5.3 and 5.6. The next thing we do is look at our group of technologies and that supply mass control. And the guidance document gives you that. And the list of technologies, or maybe like physical containment or hydraulic containment and others that you're gonna recognize here likely also. The next thing you wanna do, you want to align your site conditions with the technology, and that's found in tables 6.3. And then Appendix A is going to give you more details about that technology. The next thing is your design and performance. Let's say you have a design and performance LCSM. We're going to design and engineer the technology to meet the goals. So this is where you do this, design, engineer the technology to meet the goals. Then you want to evaluate the performance and set metrics for that. That's found in Table 6.3 and Section 6.4. For examples could be, where a metric could be no first LNAP occurrence in your downgradient well, or the LNAP body footprint has stabilized. And again, other metrics can be found in Tables 5.2 and 6.3. Okay, so now we're going to talk about some mass recovery technologies. Okay, mass recovery technologies are down here in the lower left. As you can see, some examples are skimming and excavation. Now with mass recovery, like we've talked about, we're going to recover the LNAP body migration by removal of LNAP mass. Now with mass recovery, we address the saturation-based LNAP remediation goals. Now, these technologies recover LNAP via physical removal, such as excavation, or LNAP saturated soils. Or another example is fluid recovery, like LNAP pumping and skimming. Some SMART objectives you can have for the mass recovery are recover LNAP to a practicable limit, or LNAP transmissivity. So let's talk about some, here's our ternary diagram on the bottom, and you can see that we're at the dots on the MR, standing for mass recovery. So some simple fluid recovery techniques are skimming, total liquid extraction, and that was formerly called dual pump liquid extraction, and vacuum enhanced skimming or vacuum enhanced fluid recovery or multi-phase extraction. So we all know what excavation is. Excavation can remove LNAP residuals, but it's limited by what you can reach. So all you want to know more about these, refer to tables 6.1, 6.2, and 6.3 in Appendix A in the guidance document. Now let's talk about some example performance metrics. So with some of these are, here are some example performance metrics is whenever for mass recovery. Now here's some, they are found in tables 5.2 and 6.3 in the guidance document. Some of them, here's one, LNAP transmissivity, reduction of transmissivity over time to assess performance. That's a good metric. Another one is your asymptotic recovery. This is the green line here at the bottom. As time goes along, you're going to get asymptotic on your recovery rate, showing you're reaching the endpoint, your technological endpoint of recovery system. Another is dollars per gallon of LNAP recovered. So that can be a unit cost, can also be a metric. Now the cost may outweigh the benefits for the amount of LNAP recovered. Now the graphic shows dollars per gallons for LNAP. So as the system approaches its endpoint, you have less LNAP recovered, and while O&M costs continue to remain at a constant level or even increase. This shows that the LNAP removal as measured in the cost per gallon recovered. Okay, so here you all recall the coffee cup steam that Tom talked about earlier. Now, phase change technologies do not directly remove LNAP as do the mass recovery technologies, but instead, phase change technologies change the LNAP to other phases. It does this by increasing the rates of volatilization and dissolution and degradation of the LNAP constituents. Now in phase change technologies, an example goal can be abate the unacceptable vapor concentrations by depletion of volatiles from LNAP. Or you can reduce the LNAP constituents at a point of compliance by sufficient depletion of soluble constituents from the LNAP. Okay, so here we go. Now we're going to talk about some ambient phase change technologies. Now you notice the dot on the ternary diagram is in the top under PC, standing for phase change. Now, some ambient technologies for a phase change is like NSCD, like we just heard from Tom, air sparging and SVE and biosparging, and MPE and phytotechnologies can also serve as a phase change technologies. You just want to refer to table 6.1, 6.2, 6.3, and appendix A. Okay, so here are some example smart metrics for phase change technologies. The soil phase concentration is stable or decreasing. The soil concentrations are stable or decreasing, or they reach the regulatory limits, or you reduce it to regulatory limits. You have asymptotic performance of the recovery system, and either your volatile or your soluble constituents are reduced to phase change to the risk-based standards. Just want to make sure and refer to tables 5.2 and 6.3 for additional metrics. Now let's talk about some in situ technologies. They are both mass recovery and phase change. And this is the ternary diagram where you can see these in situ technologies serve as both. Okay, as you can see from the ternary diagram on the diagram here, that thermal technologies can be both phase change and mass recovery. And you, if you refer to the guidance document, you're going to see several phase change, several in situ thermal technologies that you can probably understand a little bit better. So some metrics for in situ thermal technologies, LNAPL transmissivity is a good one. Soil concentration at a regulatory standard has been achieved, or your dissolved phase concentration is at a regulatory standard. Again, that cost per unit volume that I showed you earlier, and asymptotic mass removal, just to make sure I refer to tables 5.2 and 6.3. So now you have a snapshot of the 21 technologies in the guidance document, their grouping, and how to select them. And you're going to find more about all these technologies in the guidance document. Now, next, we're going to have a Q&A, and then we're going to turn it over to Tom Fox of Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety, and also Joanne Dyson of GHD.
Lloyd, are we ready for our Q&A?
Yes, we are.
All right, perfect. I'm just going to take back control. All right. Thank you, Lloyd. And at this time, we will begin our first Q&A verbal portion of the training. So before we do start, just one reminder that if you are interested in receiving a certificate of completion for this training, it will be available at the end of the training by completing the feedback form and by checking the box to certify that you participated in today's training. So with that reminder, we will look to our Q&A box now. If you guys have any questions for the trainers, please enter it in and we will get to them verbally and then move on with the rest of our training. So first question. What LNAPL types have higher degradation rates, which don't have much which do not have much biodegradation?
That's a good question. So here's our theory. We don't see a whole lot of difference. Certainly a slightly lower NSCD rate for the petroleum DNAPLs. For the submerged, more weathered NAPLs, but the numbers are still coming in even on that. So in general, there's no petroleum type that we're saying does not have NSCD ongoing, and we recommend measuring on all product sites. The reason for that is the direct contact biodegradation that I mentioned earlier. We have bugs growing right on all types of oil and they love it. So hopefully that answers your question. They all have biodegradation happening.
Tom, next question. What is the best way to measure thermal gradients for NSZD?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways. I'm going to sidestep ITRC a little bit because the CRC CARE document's a little bit better, more comprehensive on this one. But you can measure temperatures in well casings just to kind of screen your site to see if you have a warmer portion of that casing to just get a pre sort of screen on temperatures in that hydrocarbon oxidation zone. However, by far the best way is to bury thermocouples. And so there are a couple of different systems out there that you can purchase and require drilling of a borehole, burying the probes in the ground, basically sand packing or grouting those in so they're in nice sort of thermodynamic contact with the surrounding formation to get true temperatures of soil right around it. So that's the one that I would recommend. The screening is good just to see if you might see some temperatures.
Thank you.
And anybody else, feel free to jump in. I'll just throw the starting point out there.
Thank you, Tom. Do any other trainers have any comments on those questions? No? Okay. We'll read the next one. When NSD processes first began to occur, how long does it take to observe measurable results?
Yeah, you know, there are some papers out there from the Bemidji site. So on the order of a year to two, let's say, roughly. Not very long. It's certainly not within a month. And it certainly depends on certain site conditions like temperature. So if you're in an equatorial type of climate, nice and warm, the bugs are going to be cranking away and happy when you give them the oil. For colder sites, you know, more temperate sites, maybe a little longer time to ramp up. So, but in general, if I remember that paper right from Bemidji, it was on the order of 1 to 3 years and it's cranked up.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Do any other trainers have any comment on that question?
I think that's a good example of why you want to start measuring NSZD earlier and not waiting to the end of your remediation cycle to see what NSZD is at that time.
Okay. Thank you, Lloyd. We got another question in the Q&A box, so I will read it now. How do you get the state regulators to buy into the NSD as a remedial action?
I got to say, you guys, I'm loving the NSCD question. Yeah.
It's supposed to be the question for the regulator, I guess. I don't know. Well, every state's different, of course. Everybody has different rules they need to follow. And as a regulator in Colorado, you know, we have our own set of rules. I'd say you want to work closely in providing information to the regulator about what you're doing and what you're learning today in this webinar and what's in the LNAPL document about NSCD. And I think you'll have some success. But realize also that the state you're working in may have rules that preclude including NSZD. And so simply that's a regulatory or a statutory roadblock to implementing what's scientifically based. And you may simply need to work with your regulator to find a common path around that issue.
I found, you know, an easy entry point is just this is M&A. And we've talked about the biogas. And so if you can bring some data to show, you know, the biogas portion of the biodegradation that's occurring, then it gets easier to navigate, I guess, the regulatory avenue there, just because it's another one of the processes under M&A. So we're still talking about that same technology that they've probably approved at other sites before. And it's just a little more math involved in more fully quantifying how much is happening. So sometimes that could be helpful.
Another example is just going out there with your regulator and just wanting to have them agree, can we just go test it and see if it is out there and occurring? If in the whole scheme of things, sampling for NSAID by one of these methods that Tom talked about is not all that expensive. If you can go out there and just see if NSAID is occurring, that would go a long way to help the regulator understand that it is out there.
We have one more question, so I will read it. And if anybody has anything that they think of, please enter it now, and then we will address it before moving on. Last question is it best to perform passive flux traps at several locations within a plume? Is there a benefit for down gradient monitoring?
Yeah, you definitely need to measure multiple locations. The rates of NSAID vary geospatially across your site as well as with time. So those are pretty important things to understand when you're designing your monitoring program, to make sure you've got the spatial thing covered as well as the time thing covered. So obviously in certain areas where temperatures and climates are maybe more monotonous, not so much, but certainly in temperate climates. The downgradient part, you know, this is an LNAPL or petroleum NAPL thing. So you won't see a large CO2 signature or certainly something differentiable from the natural organic matter over your dissolved phase plume. It needs to be right over your NAPL footprint. So benefit of downgradient monitoring, that question kind of comes with a bit of a hitch. If you're on the downgradient part of the NAPL body, sure. But if you're in the dissolved phase, no need.
And I'll just throw in also, when you are actually looking at ordering the traps to use, there's a minimum of 5 anyway at your site. So at least that's what I found. So you're gonna at least start with that number of locations. So, and one of the things we've been doing is we've been using the DCC CO2 flux measurements to use that as sort of to screen the site to determine where we want to place the traps, because the traps are a lot more expensive with the laboratory analysis and everything than going out and doing the DCC analysis, which is, you know, the equipment but time on site for that. So we've been using both of those at sites.
Good add.
All right, thank you, Tom and Joanne. We do have one last question that we will read out loud. What size split is large enough to make an NSAID cost effective?
I think they're meaning what's the minimum or maximum size where NSAID could be gainfully employed, Tom.
Like that phrase. I can say we're using it on sites that are 0.1 acres. And I can say we're using it on sites that are 100 acres. So in terms of area wise, there's no split. It's measurable and effective for all size NAPL bodies, if that helps.
Okay. All right, thank you, Tom, and the rest of the trainers for answering those questions. With that, we will move on to our next section, which will be Joanne and Tom. Joanne, I'm giving you control now.
Okay. All right, Joanne, you're driving.
All right.
All right, so let me kick off this segment of our seminar today. And let's circle back to why we're here. And we're trying to learn the technology selection process. We have these 3 different groupings. We have over 20 different technologies that we could choose from in the LNAPL document. It gets a little bit overwhelming. So what we're trying to do here is to learn to apply a remedy to our site. And so, Joanne, I think there's a click here, or maybe you already did it, where we're going to learn about the technology process. There we go. You're ahead of me. So next one. So in trainings one and two, we've already covered the topics that are shown in this portion of the guidance process flow diagram in figure 1-1 in the document. And so go ahead and advance it, Joanne. Today, we're talking about this portion of the LCSM that deals with remedy selection and implementation of the cleanup. So let's step on a little bit further. This is a portion of the process flow diagram in more detail. This is figure 6-1 in the document. And basically, we're looking at a preliminary screening step initially. So I think, Joanne, if you click, it'll highlight center. You go, the purple part. In this portion of the preliminary screening, the goal here is to identify all the possible technologies for your site. And you do this by going through the Series A tables, which I've mentioned, and then go ahead and click again, Joanne. This section here, section 6.3.1 in the document, gives you an evaluation of the technologies. And then go ahead and click a third time, Joanne.
Well, it's not. Just back up.
Go backwards. There we go. The implementation portion. So this is where you begin to, and what we're going to be covering today is in more detail, is how to design, use your LCSM to design and monitor performance using metrics and endpoints to get yourself to meet your SMART objectives and get your site closed. So a little bit of a ragged step as Joanne and I walk our way through the slides here, but that's okay. So here we are now. The next slide is we're gonna walk you through a case study where Joanne and I basically have a conversation, and she's going to walk you through a case study that she was involved with personally and give you a quick overview, an example of how the selection process actually works in real life. So I'm going to play the part of a regulator, no surprise there. And I'm interested, Joanne, in knowing a little bit more about this LNAPL site that you had, and you remediated it, and how you use this LNAPL process as a consultant. And so can you tell me about it?
All right, sure. I would be happy to go over the project. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the site itself. So this was an active filling station with a small convenience store. And in 2000, a leak was discovered that was determined to be a piping leak from a gasoline underground storage tank. And through groundwater monitoring over several years, we knew that the water table was typically 5 to 6 feet. Five to six feet below surface grade, but it fluctuated seasonally as much as 2.5 feet above and below that level. Groundwater flow was observed to the east and the southeast the majority of the time, but it was also observed to the northeast on occasion. And the dissolved phase contaminants of concern were above regulatory limits were BTEX compounds, MTBE, and 1,2-dichloroethane or 1,2-DCA. There were apartment buildings and residences surrounding the station, and all the residences have basements and sump pumps. There's also an alley here that runs between the site and the apartments with the utility corridor. So all of this information was used to build our initial LCSM for the site. And if you refer to section 4 of LNAPL guidance, it discusses the evolution of the LCSM from the initial stages through corrective action. Section 4.2 provides key questions to the development of the initial LCSM, and it gives you questions such as, is the source and extent of the LNAPL known? Are dissolved or vapor plumes characterized, and are exposure pathways complete? And at this point in our investigation, the source appeared to be limited to the tank basin area, and we had characterized the dissolved phase plume. So we know the source area was likely larger at one time based on the size of the dissolved phase plume. Since vapors were a concern, Since vapors were a concern at the site, this is a good time to refer to the ITRC petroleum vapor or PVI document. And due to the dissolved phase plume, section 3.3 of the PVI shows that we need a vertical separation of at least 5 feet between the building foundation and the water table to say that we have an incomplete pathway and that no further investigation would be needed. So at this site, with the basements and the fluctuating water table, we knew that the vertical separation was too small to discount vapor intrusion. So since we needed to learn more about the potential exposure pathways, we started monitoring vapors below the apartment building and soil gas near the downgradient residences. All right, so after about 3 years of groundwater monitoring, LNAPL appeared in monitoring well MW1 with thicknesses of up to half a foot. And with this new observation, we clearly needed to define the extent of LNAPL outside the tank basin and redevelop our LCSM. So we did an LIF investigation, a laser-induced fluorescence investigation, to delineate the source and to determine the extent of LNAPL. So this investigation indicated that we had an LNAPL body around MW1 and to the southeast towards the alley with LNAPL at a depth of approximately 8 feet below surface grade. After about 8 years, eight years after the release, LNAPL was observed in this downgradient well MW4 with thicknesses up to 0.8 feet. We noticed that this occurred when the water table at the site had dropped 3 to 5 feet. So we did an additional LIF investigation so that we could determine if LNAPL had migrated in the past from MW1 to MW4 and was now being exposed by the dropping water table, or if LNAPL was, if the migration was more current due to this low water table condition. All right, so the additional LIF investigation showed LNAPL along the path from MW1 to MW4 that previously wasn't observed. So we looked at, we had locations throughout this region in our initial investigation. In the second investigation, we tried to duplicate those points as much as possible within several feet. And we observed LNAPL that was not there during the original investigation. So this would indicate that LNAPL migrated under the current low water table from the area around MW1 to the residential property to the southeast. So we already knew that there were potential vapor intrusion risks at the adjacent apartments and nearby residences due to the dissolved phase contamination. But now there was a potential risk of LNAPL in the basements or the sumps of these downgradient residences if this migration continued. So referring back to the question in section 4.2 of the guidance about the LNAPL source and extent, we now knew the LNAPL body was not stable, but was migrating to the southeast. So now we would have to say that the extent was unknown. All right, so a little bit more about the site. So this is a plan view that shows the LNAPL plume that's determined from the LIF investigations, and this red area is the most saturated area of LNAPL. So next we're gonna look at a couple of cross sections. So we can see the soil heterogeneity at the site, and also we'll be able to see the vertical distribution of LNAPL. So first we'll do A to A prime, west to east across the site. So that'll include the tank basin area and the apartments. And then B to B prime is northwest to southeast. So it's more along the pathway of the LNAPL migration. All right, so the first cross section. So a couple of things to notice on here. This is our tank basin area. Here's the apartments. And here's a tank basin here. You can see the LNAPL is noted. The highest saturation LNAPL is really not very highly distributed vertically in this area. It's close to the tank basin, slightly deeper than the tank basin. And this other green is additional LNAPL that was observed from other historical releases. This is right in the tank basin area. The blue is the high water table. The red is the low water table. And one thing you note is that we've got a smear zone of the LNAPL throughout this, pretty well throughout this water table. So at the native soil at the site is mainly a clay-rich till, but there are sand lenses. All of these lenses in here are sand lenses anywhere from 4 inches to 5 feet thick. And we observe these located throughout the area, depths of 5 feet to 26 feet below surface grade. All right, and the next cross section. So again, this is more along the lines of the LNAPL migration. So MW1, MW4, again, high water table and low water table. You can see the LNAPL and you can see this migration path from under the tank basin area down to MW4. And one thing you notice is that now our smear zone is only in the lower portion of the water table of this fluctuation zone because it hasn't been there as long and the water table has been low during this time of migration. Again, you can see all the sand lenses that are spread throughout the soil, throughout the units.
Well, Joanne, looks like you have really gone through a very thorough LCSM at this site, and you've used a lot of information from our prior training. So I know the first step now in choosing a remediation technology or strategy is determine your remediation goals and your objectives based on your site concerns. And so using those along with table 6-3 that's in the document, you would develop a subset of possible technologies that you'd use. So from a regulator perspective, it looks like you have a lot of concerns at this site that involve the protection of human health and the environment. So can you take me through what your first screening step was for your site?
Right. So we had several concerns at the site, which I'm sure people have already picked up on some of these. We have mobile LNAPL that's migrating to the southeast during periods of low groundwater. We also had dissolved phase contamination that was above regulatory limits, potential vapor intrusion issues. And we also, although it wasn't a concern, we did have an additional factor that we had to consider. That I've called, the site was moved to the aggressive site status cleanup by the agency, meaning they wanted us to consider more aggressive cleanup methods as opposed to something that might be known to take longer time periods. So that was an additional factor. They really wanted us to focus on this site for the cleanup.
Okay, so let's do a quick poll or a knowledge check question for everybody who's here. We'd like to know which concern would you consider to be the highest priority for this site? Is it migrating LNAPL? Is it that you have a large dissolved plume above the regulatory limits? The contaminants of concern include BTEX, MTBE, and 1,2-DCA. Or is it that the vapor plume and vapor intrusion risks to offsite properties are a concern? And is there just insufficient information to really judge? So while Devin gathers up your votes, which concern is the highest priority at this site? All right, and it looks like the majority, Joanne, are choosing the vapor intrusion risks to offsite properties.
Great,
what did
great.
You decide for this site?
All right, thanks, Devin. Okay, so looking at the vapor intrusion issues, if we had been monitoring vapor intrusion, so obviously if there were risks associated with that, if we had actually found completed pathways, then that would be an issue we would have to deal with quicker. We would have to deal with would be more of a priority. But we had been monitoring, we had not observed any completed pathways. So we decided to concentrate on the migrating LNAPL, knowing that in addition to the risk of the LNAPL itself having a potential of entering basements or sump pumps, that this could create a higher dissolved phase and vapor phase, vapor intrusion risks at the downgradient resonances if the migration continued. We also realized that it may be possible to address more than one concern with the right technology. All right, so moving forward with that, for step one of our screening process, we needed to identify a goal and objective to remediate our migrating El Napo concern, as was discussed earlier in the presentation. So here's a section of table 6.3. The columns in this table are remedial goals, El Napo remediation objectives, technology groups, possible technologies, and applicable site conditions. There is an additional column that we're not going to discuss at this point that includes examples of performance metrics. So for step one, we determined that the El Napo remedial goal for the site corresponded to our concern is to terminate the El Napo body migration and reduce potential for El Napo migration. The remediation objective that we selected, so notice that with this goal, there's two options for remediation objectives. And we chose our remediation objective to abate El Napo body migration by sufficient physical removal of El Napo mass. And the technology group that we would use for that objective would be El Napo mass recovery. And that includes these five potentially useful El Napo technologies. So we initially considered excavation, skimming, vacuum enhanced skimming, total liquid extraction, and MPE. All right. So even though the full list of geologic factors and detailed information about these technologies can be found in the A-series tables in Appendix A, which has been mentioned several times, this table summarizes several of the three factors for each of the technologies that are listed and provides an additional screening or an early screening of the technologies at this step without having to delve into those A-series tables. So the geologic factors on this table are geology. So whether the soils at the site are fine-grained or coarse-grained, the impacted zone, is your El Napo in the saturated zone or unsaturated zone, and then the type of El Napo, whether it's more of a low volatility solubility or a high volatility solubility. So since our site was mainly fine-grained, we were able to eliminate skimming and total liquid extraction from we were able to eliminate these two technologies from further consideration because they're mostly successful when applied to a coarse grain site. All these other technologies work for both coarse or fine, can be successful in both of those cases. So we would retain those for further consideration.
Great, Joanne. It sounds like you made a really good decision to eliminate skimming and total liquid extraction. So I'm assuming you evaluated your LCSM at this stage, and we certainly don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. And doing this extra step adds an extra layer of comfort to ensure that we're protecting human health and the environment. So this next step in the technology screening process is the one that you show here in red. Was your LCSM thorough enough to move forward with the three remaining technologies that you'd chosen?
All right, so section 4.4 of the El Napo guidance has key questions for developing this remedy selection. And these questions range from general topics to more El Napo specific topics. So some questions focus on the source, such as where is it, how is it distributed above and below the water table? So it really steps you through some of those important things that you need to know about your source area. Other questions include more general topics, such as what's achievable for a given technology. So it's more specific to identifying the technology. So after reviewing the topics at this stage, we determined that we didn't need to collect any additional field data to move forward. We had already done two LIF investigations in addition to just the general other initial investigations, you know, looking at soil contamination, ground dissolve phase, utility backfill investigations. We've got the vapor intrusion data. So we had all the data that we needed at this point. Some of the elements of the LCSM that were important for remedy selection at this stage included things like knowing that the permeability of the soil was low for a good portions of the site and that the source was submerged below the water table.
Good, good. Okay, so step three of the remediation selection process would be to screen the remaining three technologies that you've already got in hand from step one using geologic factors in the A-series tables in Appendix A. Were you able to narrow down your list based on the additional site geologic factors?
All right, so in addition to the geologic factors, the A-series tables have some other general information about the technologies. So let's look at an example for the vacuum enhanced skimming. The top, of course, this is just condensed to make this a little bit easier reading during the training, but if you can, hopefully you can see this at the top of the table, there's descriptions of technology, remediation process, objective applicability, and then applicable LNAPL type. And at this stage, we are looking at the bottom of the table where we have the geologic factors. So it includes information for both the saturated and the unsaturated zones. And then for each of those, we get permeability, grain size, heterogeneity, and consolidation. So we get information on using vacuum enhanced skimming for all of these different geologic factors. So for us in particular, the information that's included in the saturated zone permeability was beneficial to our screening. So let's take a look at that, a little bit deeper look. So the permeability description told us that vacuum enhanced skimming would be more successful in high permeability soils. And although LNAPL at the site is in some of the lower, in the higher permeable lenses, most of the site is that clay-rich till soil. So based on this, we determined that vacuum enhanced skimming was not a good fit for the site. And so then at this stage, so we decided to not include that for any further evaluation. Again, you wanna go through this same sort of evaluation for anything that's left on your list. So looking at the other two, we determined that those two were still, we were still able to include those in our screening process. So now we have just excavation and multi-phase extraction on our short list.
Good, good. So if you only had one technology left after the preliminary screening process, you would have only needed to reevaluate the site goals and objectives to decide what to do. And if you had one technology, this next evaluation, which I believe you're supposed to click at this point, this right. next step in the process, okay, is to further evaluate and refine the technology shortlist, moving on to other technology evaluation factors that are in the B series tables. So take us on through your process going through this next step.
And you're still you. You get one more.
Sorry, I did not turn the page. So much for the conversation. So here are the 3-9 evaluation factors that are included in table 6-4 in the document. The next step in the process involves reviewing these evaluation factors and ranking the top 4 to 6 that are important at your site based on considerations. So then using these B series tables to compare the different technologies, what did you come up with, Joanne? I'm sorry, I'm supposed to still continue. So we're doing an example from table 6-4 for the site restrictions as an example. So table 6-4 defines each evaluation factor and then gives general examples of possible impacts to the selection of the technology. So here we have, for example, that we have for site restrictions for evaluation factors, whether we have physical, logistical, or legal obstacles to system deployment, and then what impact those things might have. So Joanne, what evaluation factors were important at your site?
All right, so these are the four that we decided were the most important for the site: the remedial timeframe, site restrictions, waste stream management, and safety. So remedial timeframe was because we were under the priority cleanup status by the regulatory agency. So we did want to keep the timeframe in mind as we were going through and making other decisions. Site restrictions. So this site had no easy way to connect for sewer connections for any kind of a waste management, any water that we might need to discharge. There's also no three-phase power nearby. And as you can see from earlier site maps, there's many underground utilities that utility corridor in that's the alley that separates the site from the downgradient resident, and El Napple is on both sides and through the alley. Waste stream management was a concern, a big concern, because we knew that this was going to be necessary for any of the technologies that were still being considered. Some types of waste stream management. So water, discharging water is pretty obvious that we would have to do, or if we do excavation, we would have the contaminated soil. Some others to consider would be like vapor and noise mitigation would need to be done. And we knew we could deal with some of those things, but the site definitely could not very easily handle a large volume of wastewater. And then safety was a concern. It is a fairly small area that we would need to be working in. It's a small corner gas station on a corner lot in a city. So it's a small area. It's an active station. It is located adjacent to a highway and then also the residential area, which means there's some foot traffic.
Okay, so the B series table in Appendix A gives specific impacts of each of the 9 evaluation factors that we're talking about for each remediation technology. And in this example for excavation, we see that the site restriction is a high concern. You can click and highlight that area, Joanne, so everybody can see it. Okay, and that there's then a discussion giving details to consider that it's a very disruptive technology, and often due to it, excavation is often infeasible due to site restrictions.
Okay, let me go back.
Yeah, it sometimes hangs up. I don't
there. Know why. Okay, it just was slow there. All right, so one thing that you can do is you can create a table using the B-series table. You can look at the evaluation factors. Here's the four that we had that we decided were our priority. Here's the two technologies we were still considering. So taking the B-series table, we can just quickly makes this easy to evaluate the remaining technologies. This could also be useful if you needed to have some stakeholder conversations or to discuss, you know, why you would how you would go at this stage for picking which, you know, the technology you would want to move forward with, or maybe showing why neither one would still be a good fit for the site. So here's what we have for our site. And then if we start with looking at where do we have high concerns? So for all the high concerns are under excavation. So the site restrictions is a high concern because you need to be concerned about that if you're going to do excavation. This site we had was heavy in infrastructure in the area concerned, such as we have an active tank basin, the apartment building, the alley, the offsite garage, and traffic through the alley. So, and then waste stream management, because we knew that was going to be difficult at this site. It was a small site. So even though we do have this low remedial time frame for our site for excavation in general, that was one thing that was a priority for the site. We just decided there were too many high concerns, so excavation was eliminated. So now you still want to continue and go through and look at any other technologies that are left. And looking at multi-phase extraction, we only had moderate. All of these factors that we're using to evaluate only have moderate concerns. So we did keep MPE for further consideration. And let's see. There.
Here we go. So our next step is to review the LCSM based on design and performance metrics provided in the C-series tables in the appendix for the technology that is still being considered, which is multi-phase extraction at this point. So the LCSM for the site has to include knowledge related to the metrics you would use to monitor multi-phase extraction being implemented at the site. So let's take a look at, a little bit of a mess up there.
It's slow, like you said. It's been fixing itself. Let's see if it does. Might have to go back.
There you go. Okay.
There we go.
There we go. So let's take a look at an example of design and performance metrics in the C-series table for multi-phase extraction, or MPE. Examples of design metrics include the number of extraction wells and the conveyance piping that you're going to need to install. Examples of performance metrics include the depth of groundwater and LNAPL recovery rates and volumes that you'd be dealing with. Information related to these data requirements and metrics should be part of the LCSM at this point, since these will need to be part of the full-scale design, and then they have to be measured to show that multi-phase extraction is progressing. So Joanne, was it necessary for you to update your LCSM to factor in the multi-phase extraction performance metrics?
All right, so this is a good time to refer to the design and performance LCSM questions in 6.4.1 to see if we need to update. And then answering these questions along with determining metrics and endpoints is also a good way to develop those SMART objectives for your site. So an example of a question in this section that would be applicable at this time is, what are the conditions to be created by the selected technology that will accelerate LNAPL depletion? So in our case, we're thinking about MPE, lowering the water table at the site was one condition that we needed to obtain since LNAPL was in the saturated zone. Another question is, what conditions will demonstrate the desired LNAPL changes? So this leads you to thinking about, it's important to consider the endpoints. What endpoints for your technology implementation would you decide on? So in this case, our endpoints included reduced LNAPL occurrence in the downgradient monitoring well as an indication of reducing LNAPL migration, and that would be a saturation change goal. And then also declining dissolved phase contaminant concentrations for lower vapor intrusion risks, which would be a compositional change. So we already had a lot of the site information that would be necessary to implement MPE technology, such as the depth to the bottom of the LNAPL zone, which would be the target for dewatering. But our LCSM was missing information such as the radius of influence, the ROI of for dewatering that would be needed for MPE implementation.
Good, good. Well, the next step in the process is to review the minimum data requirements and the critical technology evaluation needed for multi-phase extraction. And we're going to use the C-series tables in Appendix A to do that now.
There
we go. So here's an example from the C-series tables for multi-phase extraction. And if you could just click once, Joanne. Okay, so here's an example of multi-phase extraction, which includes determining hydraulic conductivity and transmissivity. We also have to look at LNAPL conductivity and transmissivity. So we have to look at both the water and the LNAPL phases. And we also look at the LNAPL characteristics. So critical technology information, if you could click one more time, Joanne, I think there we go. Okay, might include some necessary bench testing and pilot testing in order to determine such things as the radius of influence that Joanne just referred to. All of this information can be considered to further evaluate the technologies. And then if no technology can be determined, it's time to reevaluate the objectives or goals And this involves a conversation with your regulator and your technical people to come up with what your other alternatives might be. So for this case study we're discussing, there is only one technology left prior to reviewing the C-Series table, and that was multi-phase extraction. So Joanne, what did you do at this point?
All right, so next we conducted a pilot test to gather that additional data that was shown in the C-Series table for MPE and to update the LCSM. So the information we needed, as we said, was we still needed to determine the radius of influence, and we also needed to determine recovery rates, which would indicate how well MPE was going to work at the site. And then that information would also help us determine how many wells would be needed if we moved forward with a full-scale implementation. So for the pilot test, we did have to work with the city to have three-phase power installed at the site. And initially, we had to have water tanks on site. Well, for the pilot test, we had to have some water tanks on site. This is the mobile MPE trailer that we used. This is the garage where MW4 is right here at that site. So you can see how close everything is and the narrow alley. So we did have to invest some time and money into the pilot test, but it did show that MPE should be successful at the site.
Good. Well, before implementing any technology, the guidance recommends establishing SMART objectives and your performance metrics. So the guidance recommended starting to think about this end process when you're reviewing and updating the LCSM for design and performance. It's also important to monitor the technology and constantly assess performance during implementation, and then to demonstrate that the objectives are being met. So how were you going to determine performance and success at your site?
So before we implemented the MPE, we knew that system sampling would be necessary to monitor system performance. And to show that objectives had been met, the metrics were established, including decline curve analysis for the system and also groundwater contaminant concentration decline. So those were a couple of things we were going to be looking for. Since the site was small and the LNAPL body was relatively small and time was essence for this cleanup, we decided to run a mobile MPE system instead of installing a full-scale MPE system. We did run that 24/7, just like we would for a full-scale system, because we needed to do that for dewatering. We knew that the best option for discharge water was going to be to treat it and discharge to a nearby storm drain. So before we started this phase of the project, we were no longer using the water tanks, and we obtained an MPDES permit so that we could discharge to the storm drain. We also knew that we wouldn't be remediating all the LNAPL at the site, so our treatment train would include natural source zone depletion to treat the LNAPL contamination that was going to be remaining at the site. At this stage, we had not measured any NSCD rates. And if we had already done that prior to this, at this time, NSCD was still not really well known or accepted in the state for by the regulatory agency. If we had already measured those rates, that would have been another useful endpoint for remediation, because we would have been able to compare our MPE recovery rates to our NSCD rates, which would have, again, it's additional line of evidence that it would have been a good time to stop remediation. All right, and so just looking at one example of endpoint, I'm just gonna look at the dissolve phase concentrations. So we have graphs of the gasoline range organic contamination for MW1 and MW4. And this is over the history of the sampling. So this one starts in 04 and goes to 2017. MW4, we started in 06 and went to 2017. So the time span of LNAPL occurrence in each well is noted here by these red arrows. And then you can also see the time span of system operation over the history of the site. And for MW4, you can actually see that the dissolve phase GRO levels were decreasing until LNAPL appeared in the well, which is an indication that there is potentially LNAPL in the well. Now we have dissolve phase GRO that increased. And this was the first time that we had seen LNAPL in this well. So that was another indication that LNAPL maybe migrated to the well and was not just already in the area and mobilizing into the well during the low water table. So once the MPE system was operational, we began to conduct monthly system site visits so that we could do the system sampling. And that was in addition to quarterly groundwater monitoring. So we collected system operation samples and monitored the system performance. So notice that during system operation, again, we did have some decline in GRO already, but once we started operating the system, you can see how quickly that the concentration levels declined in both of the wells. And we also no longer, we did not have LNAPL appear in the wells any further after we started system operation. So then once the decline curve analysis of the system indicated the system was no longer removing contamination efficiently, then the system was shut down. Groundwater monitoring did continue at the site for two additional years after system shutdown. And we saw that even though we had a little bit of a rebound in MW1, it did stabilize in that well, and it's remained low in MW4 and actually was decreasing, continued to decrease. So with this follow-up monitoring, both of these conditions were part of the endpoints that we had set up for prior to implementing MPE at the site. So after 2 years of this follow-up monitoring, the regulatory agency closed the site.
Good. Well, congratulations on your success and that of your client. So thanks for running through this case study with us today and showing us how the LNAPL guidance document can really be used at a real site. So let's wrap up a little bit today, and we do have some questions that we'll address here in a moment. And if you have any other questions you care to ask, please type them into the chat box or the Q&A box. So here we have some takeaways from our technology selection that you really need a robust LCSM. As I said before, if you don't understand the problem, you're not going to find the best solution. You need to also decide your concerns and your goals up front. You need to know where you're going. It's really important to recognize that the technology selection framework is very systematic. We've walked through a number of steps and referred to a number of data tables in order to support our decision process to the regulatory agency and even to our client. We have to repeat this process for each concern and goal that we have at the site. We use the technology that overlaps with multiple concerns or goals when we have the ability to do so. And in Joanne's situation, she used multi-phase extraction, which addressed the LNAPL concerns that were present in many phases. We also have to sequence the technologies as appropriate. In other words, using the treatment train principle to use the proper technology at the proper time and also know when to quit. And we have to establish performance metrics in order to realize that our technology is progressing or that it's time to stop. So with that, we have another quick knowledge check. Here we go. During the technology remediation selection process, when should the LCSM be reevaluated? And you can choose any of these answers or all of these answers as you wish. So an LCSM should be developed prior to starting the remedy selection process. It should be developed during the preliminary screening process. It should be done after further screening with the evaluation factors that we've talked about from the B series tables, or after remediation if it's unsuccessful. So you have a few minutes to register your vote. How are we doing, Devin?
Good. We're going to give it just about 10 more seconds, just as a good number of people are still answering. Right.
Vote early, vote often. And here we go. We're about evenly distributed all the way through, which is good, because that is the actual answer, is all of those factors are really useful to keep your LSCSM up to date, keeping in mind that the conceptual site model should always be revisited and always updated every time you get additional information that can help you to understand your site better. Thank you, Devin. And with that, I don't know if you want to launch into the Q&A portion.
Yep, we can go right into that. Let me just change the slide here. Here we go. Okay. All right. So thank you, John, or excuse me, Joanne and Tom, for that.
It's a combination.
I got very confused there for a second. Thank you both for that last section and walking us through that scenario. We will now begin our last question and answer portion of the training today. Make sure if you have any questions to enter those into the Q&A box. I will read the ones that we have right now. Can you please discuss at what point the cost of remediation was evaluated during the remedy selection process, and how you evaluate remediation costs in order to determine if a remediation technology is financially feasible?
That's a good question. So for this particular site, the way that the state agency worked was early on when we were looking at all the possible remediation technologies, then we had to do an abbreviated cost-effective evaluation at that stage. So so after doing that initial screening where we screened out, you know, some of the obvious things that weren't going to work well at the site due to the less permeable soil at the site. So then we would have done the cost remediation, done a cost evaluation when we were looking at multi-phase extraction and the excavation. So I guess it depends on your regulatory agency, because the one I was working with, they had a very specific timeline for when that would be included. And so part of it, you know, it did have to pass that process of just looking at a big picture, you know, what were the costs going to be and what was the life cycle of the costs. So that could be a factor. Now, in this case, maybe I didn't have to consider that as much. So the time was more of an essence than the cost. That's why that aggressive site status affected, you know, that part of the decision-making process. So I did have to determine the costs and look at the life cycles, but that did not play as big of a factor in the decision-making process.
Yeah, let me add, looking back a little bit in my notes, and since this is being re-recorded, slide 94 brought up the evaluation factors, the 9 different evaluation factors that Joanne considered. And you don't have to do that, Devin. But basically, that was the listing, and that is where cost came into play, with slide 94, if you're trying to get there. But that was where cost came into play in Joanne's decision.
Right. So if that's a big factor for what you're in, for some sites, the cost can be the driving factor. So you would want to have that in as one of your factors where you were using that for consideration.
Yes. If I could add too, that when you're deciding on your remedial LCSM, cost weighs in there as well as your objectives and your goals. So yeah. So there's other places you can look at what the cost factor is, some of this.
All right. Thank you, trainers, for addressing that question. Next question. Possibly missed a metric point, but what was the LNAPL transmissivity estimated as part of your decision process?
Again, another really good question. You didn't miss it. I didn't mention it, because this was that was not something that was considered to be that was not part of our evaluation at the site. We never did do LNAPL transmissivity. At the time, that was still something that I think we were learning about. You know, LNAPL, this LNAPL document, the first one came out several years after the site started, and it took a little while for us to learn the value of that metric. So at this point, now we know that that metric is, it's a fairly cost-effective measurement to do on site. It doesn't cost that much. It doesn't take that long to go out and gather that data. So that would have been a really good metric to have at the time for those wells. So you did not miss it, but that would have been, you know, where would we have put that in the decision process? I think that's something that would have been good for earlier on in the process when we were coming up with our initial and remedy, probably during the remedy, LCSM, somewhere in the middle of that. And I'm guessing the LNAPL document, I don't remember exactly, but that's probably one of those questions in there. I don't remember exactly which of those tables that's included in.
One other factor to keep in place is that the multi-phase extraction system wasn't just after the saturation issue of the LNAPL presence, but it was also addressing the vapor and dissolve phases of the LNAPL. Right. And coincidentally, that just happened to be the best technology to take care of all three things at once.
All right. Thank you, Joanne and Tom. Next question. On slide 107 for the gasoline station shows GOR concentrations at WM4 decreasing from 2006 to 2011, after which LNAPL appeared in the well. What cost-effective methods could be employed to get a quicker evaluation for LNAPL migration?
That is a good question.
It is.
One thing I would throw out there while everybody else is thinking is that you'd want to look at the viscosity of the fuel that you're dealing with. Of course, as it ages, the viscosity and the ability to migrate will decrease over time. And of course, the mass then also begins to level out, and the gradient, the driving head of the LNAPL to make it migrate, is decreasing. So those are a couple thoughts from me.
You know, so I think one thing that is typically used to look for LNAPL migration is looking at these down gradient wells to see. So like in the case of the graph that we see, once we see that LNAPL is in the well and that the GRO concentrations and I'm sure other concentrations increase as well. I just only grabbed the GRO data. You know, looking at having some additional wells down gradient to monitor that migration pathway. At this site, the downside of that was time. So that is something that, you know, you can see how long it took over, you know, the course of the site for that to occur, you know, for the migration to happen. And a lot of the reason we saw it was because the water table dropped. So the conditions just were right for that migration. So I don't know, others, anybody else have some chime in?
I guess I'll add a little bit there. The word migration, I think, is probably a bit tricky there. It could be just like, you know, Joanne mentioned, the dynamics of the water table rise and fall create a situation where an apple appears and disappears in a well,
right,
that it was already there. So high water table times, it's submerged, the higher residual doesn't seep into a well. But when you get that drop in water, yeah, interestingly, concurrent with a DRO drop, it's just odd timing. I don't think it's necessarily indicative of anything besides just the dynamics of the hydraulics at the site. I would be hesitant to use word migrating. This is more mobile. You know, it was mobilized from a water table drop.
Right. Well, and that's why we did the LIF, because how do you know the difference? You know, that's the question. Is it mobile? Was it already there and it just appeared in the well because of the water table drop? Because at this site, when we plotted water table elevations versus LNAPL thickness, we could tell you the water table level at each in each well up gradient, where like in MW1, we knew exactly what elevation the water table would hit when we would start to see the LNAPL in the well. So where I have the LNAPL showing up in the well, it wasn't consistently in the well at that over that time period. It would come and go, and it was inversely related to the water table elevation. So the water table would drop, we would see some LNAPL, it would go back up, and it would disappear. So we would see it with the seasonal fluctuation. But in MW4, you know, that was the big question, was once we saw it there, did it migrate earlier or not? So that was why the LIF was implemented in that case, because we wanted to see if actually LNAPL had been in the area previously. And that was, LIF is one of the few ways you can really see the migration of the LNAPL over time if you do more than one investigation. A lot of people may not have that option because of all the down gradient residences and that migrating pathway. You know, that was a big concern for this site.
Yeah, the simplest way to deal with this would be to make sure you've got your hydrograph where you're tracking your water level and your contaminant concentrations and or presence of LNAPL in a well over time. And you may be able to pick up on the relationship that Joanne's talking about.
Right.
Another thing there, the question is asked about a cost-effective method could be employed to get a quicker evaluation for LNAPL migration. Well, there's another possibility. You could do a transmissivity test, and if you have very low transmissivity, it's probably not migrating.
Thank you, trainers. We do have one more question. Slide 107 seems to indicate that LNAPL recovery reduced dissolved phase concentrations. Is that correct, or did a phase change / compositional change reduce the concentrations, or are both one and the same?
Right. So, the MPE, definitely, there was definitely phase change and compositional change. That was definitely part of it. When we ran the MPE system, we did get most of the extraction was in vapor form. So we do know that the compositional change was a big part of it. So we did have some LNAPL, but that when we did the MPE system, also we did run it two separate parts. We ran up around MW1, which was, I think, a lot of the photos were when we were on that side of the alley. And then we also ran it on around MW4. So we couldn't do them all at the same time with the mobile system. So and we had to be careful with that alley because we had to block the alley off to run it in the area around MW4. So, it was probably a little bit of both, but a lot of it was the compositional change, which is again, as Tom pointed out, the advantage of the MPE system.
Okay. Thank you, Joanne. We do have one last question. Looking back, would you have done anything differently?
I do think that we would have looked, we would have wanted to get the transmissivity data would also have been a good thing to have. I don't know. I had been pushing for MPE. It took me a few years to get that. I mean, to get LIF, it took me several years to get them to let us to do LIF there, which is one reason this whole thing took a long time period, because it wasn't obvious what was happening until we did the LIF investigation. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's anything else we would have done differently or not. So that's the only thing I can think of.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, that wraps up our last Q&A. Thank you to our trainers for providing answers to those questions, and attendees, thank you for entering those questions for our trainers. If you have any other questions or would like any further clarification on any of your questions, you can email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. You're also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. Special thank you to our participants for joining us today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us for these training sessions. Remember, we do archive our classes. So if you have, if you're interested in any additional training or miss anything, then you we do have them online for on-demand viewing. Remember, we do have this feedback form that you can complete in order to get your certificate of participation. And with that, we will close up our IBT for today. Thank you all for attending, and trainers, thank you. I will see you later.
Thank you all for coming.
Bye.